What is happening, everybody? Welcome to episode 31 of The Craft. My name is Nick Pollock, and my special guest today is Eno Saris. Eno, it's been so long since I've seen you.
Yeah, it was good to see you Friday. Thanks for everybody who came out to our live podcast. We had a good time.
It was a great time. It was very hot. We were sweating. And hopefully the sheen didn't show on the live stream. No, really, that was such a great time. Thank you, everybody, for coming out. Thanks to Garage for hosting us as well. I am back in New York now. Eno is still in San Francisco because he lives there. Shocking. What we're going to do today is we're going to talk about a couple guys that Eno has done some fantastic research on, Sean Manaea and others. And also, I want to pick Eno's brain a little bit about some of the rankings he has for rest of season. I obviously have been doing these on Monday as well, but not really as straight of a ranking as Eno does, which makes it a lot more fun because I don't have a rank of this guy versus this guy. I just have tiers. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a great time. But Eno, I wanted you to take it away really early. You had some interesting things on Sean Manaea that I wanted you to talk about.
Yeah, well, Sean Manaea went out and watched some Chris Sale and was like, hey, that guy's pretty good.
Pretty good.
And so he decided to drop his arm slot to kind of match Chris Sale's. Huh. And, first of all, I think slots are really hard thing to change. I can't believe you changed.
Yeah, right.
And I think I think it's a little risky.
Why is that?
Well, first of all, the research suggests that sidearm is more stressful on your elbow.
You know, that's interesting you say that, because ever since I was a kid, we were seeing Randy Johnson do this, and every single coach would say, no, it hurts to do that. I've understood it right is if you move your entire torso, like you have a certain arm slot, it's something we've talked about a lot, is that every pitcher has a natural arm slot. And you can change it, but you just need to change your entire torso with it. Like you can't keep your shoulders in the same place and change your arm slot. You got to move your shoulders too.
That's huge. And I had Cam Lanzilli, who works with Connect Pro, Casey Mulholland down in Florida. He reached out to me and he said that, how consistent does the trunk elbow ball release stay?
Okay, hold on a second. The trunk elbow ball release. So yeah,
he wants to.
What is the trunk elbow?
I think he's saying that he says matching the plane. If the arm stops matching the plane of the trunk, he's what you say. He's saying what you're saying.
Yeah. I never heard of that phrase. There's times I'm sure if I'm having some sort of slip up, I'm sure a lot of people listening are too.
Oh, I mean, it's jargon. Yeah, I'm just trying to explain it. So trunk is you're talking about shoulders. Trunk is shoulders. Yeah. It's just the whole body.
It's the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know that I can with my eyes sort of say that. That's something that Hawkeye would do a good job of. But generally, and this goes back to Josh Kalk, who now runs helps run the Mariners, runs the pitching for the Mariners, or just, he's an AGM there, I think. He had a public piece called Finding the Injury Zone, which you can find on the Hardball Times. And in it, he tries to predict injury. And one of the things that he uses is fastball velo. That's sure. One that we all still use. He uses zone percentage. I think that's the zone percentage is actually, it's like a reverse engineering. It's like they don't feel confident, so they're not going in the zone. They don't feel confident maybe because they're hurt.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's more, it's actually a thing of injury. If you can't command all of a sudden your fastball of nowhere, usually does mean that there's an injury attached to it. I get that.
And then the last one was consistency of release points. And he focused on consistency of release points, but I generally am like, if I see a dropping slot, a dropping arm slot, dropping release point, I think maybe injury. So
sure.
Logan Webb has been dropping his arm slot a little bit over time, and there hasn't really been an injury. So he's kind of one example of not. Chris Sale, over the course of this season, his release point has been dropping. it doesn't seem to be affecting him yet. It has been affecting his Stuff Plus numbers. If you looked at my latest rankings, you might have noticed that his Stuff Plus is down. But with his K-BB the way it is, with the way he's rolling and the way that he's such an established pitcher, I don't know how much of a big deal to make out of it. But I did do a little kind of just a quick query. I just did release points, you know, in August versus release points in March and April.
Yeah.
And the biggest droppers, I don't think this list is necessarily very good. So the biggest dropper is James Paxton, who is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Second is Jake Woodford. Third is Tim Hill. Tim Hill's like always been really low.
I just considered him the little brother of Rich, even though that's not true.
He's like a littler version of it.
Yeah. And then Jake Woodford is the Amish Mustang, so he just doesn't pitch on Sundays.
Okay, is he?
No. No, Wood Ford. If you have a wooden Ford.
Oh my God, Jesus.
Yeah, man. You get it now. Okay, sorry. Keep moving.
Jay Puck. I think this might be related to he's trying to start. I don't know. AJ Puck down.
Wait, so AJ Puck lowered. Oh, that makes sense because he raised it up when he was starting, and then now he's in relief. He lowered it back down.
I think so.
Yeah.
And his stuff and everything has clicked a lot better since he's
lowered. Right. I'd imagine it's Steele Hall too in the two games that we've seen.
I don't know if you had enough sample in both.
Yeah, right.
So Shamanaya is there. Andrew Nardi. Jordan Hicks is seventh. He's hurt. Bowden Francis. But at this point, we're talking about 3 inches.
Mm-hmm.
So the list has gotten closer to, you know, like James Paxton dropped 6 inches.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a lot.
So I think once that happens, you're like, woof, woof.
Yeah,
and we're making a big deal out of Shamanaya. That's 4 inches.
Now, I do want to mention there, though, going to the Red Sox, James Paxton, who was just four-seamer in curveball with the Dodgers to a laughable degree.
Four-seam cutter, yeah.
He
went from four-seam cutter.
No, they actually leaned really into the curve down with the Dodgers. But to the Red Sox, he introduced a sinker. And I do wonder if that was part of the change too for him to get more on the side of that to amplify it.
He had
like a lower half injury too. I think it was his calf or something. So
knee, I think.
Yeah.
Bowden Francis being on there. I don't know. Bowden Francis, Nick Lodolo. Francis could be tired. I mean, it's, you know, he doesn't have a ton of innings. Nick Lodolo is hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Brad Keller, Tanner Bibee. Is Bibee.
Bibee's saying he has a barking shoulder.
He does?
Yeah. So he's been saying it all year. It's been bothering him.
That sucks.
Yeah.
Christopher Sanchez, he's a sinker guy. Maybe he's looking for it. He also probably is doing pretty well on innings for his career.
Yeah.
Hunter Green hurt. Chris Bassett. Now we're talking 2.5 inches, and I don't know.
Sure.
How big deal it is.
Now, I will say, is Manaea the lowest initial arm slot of those, or was he always a high arm slot guy? I've always kind of treated Manaea and like Heaney and Lodolo like these lefty slinger types.
He's a lower end. He's lower than everybody on the list, other than obviously Tim Hill.
And maybe Sanchez? Sanchez will be saying the lower one.
He's higher. No,
okay. So, I mean, that makes me more inclined.
He's the lowest on the list.
If you're already low, does it make a larger difference or not? Is part of my thought too. Of like, if you're high up, like clearly you're trying to be up, and then you're resisting the fall, while Manaea is already down there. She's like, whatever.
Like Hunter Green does not want to go down.
Right, exactly. So
and it probably has some ramifications for what we were talking about earlier with the trunk. Like if you're already low, your trunk is already sort of, you know,
hanging out down there.
Yeah.
Right. So you're more comfortable with it. I don't know. I mean, obviously, he's had these amazing results for Shamanaya. The main thing I've really noticed, and I'm really happy that you brought up that the difference, I didn't catch that at all, was essentially his consistency of, look, it's just going to be sinkers upstairs, and then everything else is also going to be there. And I do wonder from that arm angle, especially as a lefty with an extreme side of the rubber too. I mean, his 95th percentile release point all the way over to the left, towards first base. That makes me wonder, like, the sweeper, if it's everything's already moving to the right, you know? So now that you have them going in the same spot, in the same area, it's just even harder to tell which one it is, especially if that's a very lateral sweeper, which I believe he does have. So it's kind of interesting to me that, like, yeah, cool, get a little bit lower, amplify that a little bit more of just a difficulty. And if he's able to throw strikes with this, which he has, I mean, it's been kind of, that's really the most impressive part, is that you're getting lower in the arm slot. Generally, that means it's harder to be consistent throwing strikes, and he's doing that. It's been an incredible run.
I haven't heard that relationship, but I guess you're kind of, if you're lower in the arm slot, you're kind of turning the strike zone on the side and aiming.
Exactly, and which is thinner.
Aiming within the sides as opposed to, like, if you're over the top, you're kind of like, I'm a vertical guy.
Which is actually why when I watch MLB debuts, I love your Syndergaard types. The ones that are more north-south when it comes to their approach. That to me is just, okay, cool. You're generally going to have better locations.
That's been kind of a Twins thing. I think of, like, Festa and Zebby Matthews, like, they're kind of vertical.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And Zebby Matthews, I would say, very good command. That one weird game with his fastball, who was at the Cardinals or something, that was ridiculously bad, but I actually think he's excellent with that. So, well,
okay. You have something more on?
No, please.
Well, you know, this is a name that we've talked about too much, and I don't really want to talk about him more, but he is fascinating. So Kyle Harrison. Kyle Harrison dropped his arm slot. The reason that these kind of queries are hard is because you don't know when to start and don't do the cutoffs. You don't know how much to put in each bucket. Yeah. You're like DL Hall. And I'm like, well, he didn't have enough before or after, you know?
Right.
So with Kyle Harrison, it's happening right now. So in his last start, I mean, it's really happening over his last six starts. And from six starts ago till now, he's lost. That is like 5.1 to 4.6. So he's lost
plus
six.
Five. Oh, yeah. That's, yeah. It's always weird because it's the 5 point, but then it's like, well, it's a foot for his 12. And
right,
we're doing decimals.
Do times 12. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
But
yeah, it's over 5 inches. Yeah.
He's lost 5 or 6 inches since his start against Colorado at home. On July 24th. So in 5 to 6 weeks, he's lost 6 inches on his release point. And it got all the way down to a point where he's never been before in when he was at Milwaukee on August 24th. So the beginning of July to the end of August, he lost 6 inches somewhere in July. So over the course of six starts, that's a better way to say it. Yeah. And then he recovered a little bit of it. What was interesting, though, was Manaea, when his arm slot changed, his stuff changed. Mm-hmm. And it was generally better. His stuff on his fastball in particular went up because I think he's just creating a little bit more movement. And, like, I don't know, it's somehow, even though he's still a bit of a dead zone-y fastball, it worked a little bit better when he dropped down. Kyle Harrison retained the same movement that he had, even though he dropped down.
That's interesting.
That's theoretically exciting. So his improvement in stuff plus on the fastball has been pretty large. He went from sort of 91 or 2 to 106 on the fastball.
Yeah. So I'm taking a look at this right now on our game log for Kyle Harrison. We have we don't do enough to kind of tell you guys the features of it, but essentially if you go to any sort of game and you click on the individual row or hit all on the plus, you can actually see these tabs that showcase stuff for that game for every single pitch type. So I can actually see in there, you know, X release point and Y release point. And I'm actually, according, this is like the savant straight through, like the first game of the year against the Padres, it was a 4.9 release point. And then it was a 4.8 on Tuesday yesterday, but on Wednesday it was down to 4.6 and his height adjusted VAA was 1.5 on that fastball. and it was located beautifully upstairs, and our POV had a 503 on that. Like, we liked this fastball all of a sudden.
That would be, and it was different, here, right? Like, it, I mean, in terms of moving, it was about the same, but in but terms it,
the
of,
angle is way better.
Yeah, the angle is way better, yeah.
Right, because he is lower on it. Now, yesterday against the Diamondbacks, where he got completely smoked. It went sort of smoked,
back to normal, right?
It went back to normal. The VAA, height adjusted VAA, went down to 1.2, and PLV had it at 4.57. It was worse location, too.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, you're asking a guy who doesn't have good natural command to change something.
Right.
If they're asking him, or he's hurt because his velo is down too, you know?
Yeah. Everything went down there. Well, it was the thing is, it was 92.6 in that start against Milwaukee, and then it was 91.2 against Arizona. Keep in mind, 73 pitches in three innings underneath that generally means he's more laborious, which means velocity should go down. But
general trend this year has been, he started out the year 96 and now he's 92.
Oh man. Kyle Harrison. No. So no. Yeah, I wish I had better.
You like see the Sean Manaea thing, you're like, ooh, this is something I could look for. Then you do the query and you're like, ooh. I don't know if I'd want to look for this.
Right.
And then Kyle Harrison's in the middle of doing it. You're like, oh, he kept his movement and he dropped down. Ooh, that's interesting. Yeah. And then the next start, you're like, I don't think this.
Yeah. I really want to lean into, exactly. Like, how sustainable is it? And it's what you even said about the Corbin Burns thing, which I can bring up in a moment. But, with Manaea, I think it's a perfect case of all things kind of working together. You know, obviously the dipping works, but again, and it does work for Harrison, but is it consistent? Is it, are you able to spot it still? Are you, is it working well with everything else that you have? Because I think with Manaea, more so than Harrison, it's this weird blueprint that works. And I see it a couple of times, like I saw from Cutter Crawford yesterday, where that game was just everything top half of the zone. And it was really just two pitches. It was the Cannibal McSanchez, which is the cutters at the top of the zone falling into the zone, and then four seamers staying up, and he just smattered them together into this Play-Doh ball of pitches in the top half of just four seamers and cutters, and they couldn't do anything. Like, they just didn't know and couldn't recognize out of the hand what was coming, and the Mets, you know, floundered. And I feel like that's what Manaea is doing as well. The top half, he's going these sinkers and then mixing it with that changeup and sweeper well enough that, based on maybe the arm angle of the attack angle, Alex Chamberlain, you love that, the horizontal attack angle being so similar with the other pitches that are more horizontal. Like, if you think about it with Vert, this is interesting. I never considered this. I'm probably being really stupid, but whatever. With Vert, we're all about like, okay, this is good for north-south pitching, right? Like, you want to be four seamers up and then breaking stuff down, right? There you go. There's your lovely way to amplify Vert. You want to be north south, but if you have a really extreme horizontal angle, then you can maybe play the east west game of things that are horizontal movement, and that's kind of what Manaea is doing.
Horizontal attack angle is more important for Manaea,
right? For like the lower.
And another way of saying it is, when you're in the box, let's say I'm a righty, and that's what's most important for Manaea is like, how is he going to get righties out? Because lefties, especially if he drops down a slot, lefties going to be like, I can't see that thing. You know,
right,
where that's in my peripheral. I hate
it. Yeah, exactly.
But for a righty, I'm looking at you, and I'm not looking at you. This is something we talked about a little bit at the meetup, was I'm not looking at you like the way the fan and we, the analysts, look at you.
Oh, yeah.
The hitter.
No.
We're like, from behind the box, we're looking at, this is a shape. And we describe these shapes in 2D ways. And we're like, oh, it's this parabola. It's like this, but it's 3D. And as a hitter, I'm looking at you not straight at the mound. I'm kind of looking at your release point. So I'm looking across, right? And if you're throwing pitches at me from across, you want them to look most alike horizontally.
Yeah.
Because your release point is horizontal. It's just saying what you're saying, but I'm trying to sort of emphasize that, like, the hitter is seeing this in a 3D sort of site, in like a sort of angular way, you know? Yep. And so if those pitches are coming out looking similar sideways, and then some go really far in on you and some go don't go as far in on you, that's sort of the, it's like a Madison Bumgarner too.
Yeah.
That's what Manaea almost is.
Sub 50% O swing against righties this year. Sub 50% zone rate just overall against righties. The O swing against righties hasn't really changed. I'm trying to see like what kind of trends against righties have changed, because honestly, that generally when it comes to handedness, it's like, what are you doing against righties? And that's all the time. How are you doing against righties as a pitcher? If you are having a successful run, it's usually because you found a way to get righties out.
Yeah.
Or like lefty, if you're a righty, it's like, okay, cool.
Yeah, okay, opposite.
Finally know how to do it, right?
Yeah.
But I'm seeing, yeah, I'm not really seeing that much of a difference across just the batter tendencies. I'm not seeing that quite yet. Pitch mix against righties, kind of the same. Maybe I'm missing something here. A few more sweepers than actually before. I guess there's that. A bit more of a sweeper focus. Location-wise, it's a 47% high lock usually, but no, here's the big one. Okay, here we go. I got this now. When did the whole thing start? I think the whole thing started around the 30th, let's say. Yeah, that was the 11th strikeout game. Beautiful. Oh, man, all comes together. Got it. Lock it in, you know, because what we have, I've got this. So from the start of the year, through the end of to July 29th, high location was just 22% against right-handed batters for Sean Manaea. Okay, just in general across everything that he throws. But from July 30th, that's 11 strikeout game that against the Twins that kind of made us like go, whoa, okay, what's going on here? Since then, 58% high lock across office pitches. So he really started just going, you know, I'm just going to go upstairs. And really, when we think about it, like, yeah, you want to do like changeups down, right? You want to try and do that kind of thing. Maybe get your breaking balls down and underneath the bats. He is 16% low location in that time to right-handers. And I think that's a huge, huge shift. You know, that's him just leaning into this whole thing and being like, all right, you can't pin me high-low now. You have to pin me horizontally. And I think that's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah. That
might be it. Oh.
I don't know if the HAA thing holds so well, because his horizontal approach angle is now more different between his slider and his sinker.
Oh, really?
It used to be very similar.
Oh, no. Oh,
but
man.
Good there's still something, I think, about how shapes fit together that... I think it's working for him. I do wonder if what kind of injury concerns you want to throw on top of this.
Yeah. I mean, Manaea's always kind of been one in the first place. But if you're just thinking the short term right now, I mean, obviously, I think you're just going to go with it. And it's kind of funny. He actually didn't face a single left-handed batter against the Mariners on the 10th. It was all righties, which is another hilarious thing in my view. 85 pitches all against righties, and it was all upstairs. Okay. We have other guys we want to talk about, of course. Right. And I want to go through Eno's rankings a little bit, because I think he has some, obviously some interesting takes here that I definitely want to hear. We're going to go after all of that after this break. So you have your new updated rankings. You have schedules in them. It's glorious. I applaud you for it. It takes so much time to do schedules.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Every team.
Oh man. I'm so lucky to have Josh Mockenstern to help me make mine. But it is a lot of work. And before I even start asking about specific guys, I'm curious if there were certain surprises for you of you were higher on this guy than you expected or lower on someone else.
Well, just to highlight the difficulty of doing this, I was pretty high on Bowden Francis, and you know, his projections are pretty good. The stuff is pretty good. The splitter, I think, is making this work for him. And then I saw at Boston and versus Philly, at the beginning of his, next bunch of starts. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oof, I would rather have him for the end, which is, you know, Texas, Tampa, Miami,
right,
than the beginning. But, you know, it's one of those things where like you kind of, if you want the end, you, at this point, he's such a hot name, you have to buy the beginning. Then he goes out and shoves against Boston. And I'm like, well, now the Philly start doesn't look as scary. And, you know, he's an every down back and he really should be, you know, maybe 20 points, 20 ranks higher, you know?
Yeah, right.
So, you know, there is a big split for me. And what I use like Glasnow, Darvish and Yamamoto as the split between guys that I'm more likely to start every time and guys I'm less likely to start every time. And so Bowden Francis literally could be, you know, up at 45 for me now instead of the 67 I had him at. Just that's how much the schedule can screw with you. And then right next to him at Zebby Matthews, who I was saying I want at the beginning of this and not the end, because he's got Toronto, Tampa, Angels, and then he finishes with Cleveland, Boston, Baltimore. Like I'm not sure I want that at all. Yeah. And so, you know, with Zebby, then he doesn't have a great start. And I guess, you know, some people, you know, I think that it's still good to have this there, because if Zebby doesn't have a great start now, then you're like, okay, then there's only really two more starts I'm going to start him for. You know, right. We were doing this with who, oh God, on Rates and Barrels, we're doing this with a pitcher and we're like, oh wow, there's really only one start I'd start him for, you know?
And yeah. So and that's always the toughest part. It's like, man, there are guys that you have to make these tough drops for. I mean, even Cutter Crawford, it's like, well, he gets Baltimore and the Yankees next. And it's just, I know that worked out against the Mets, but I can't do that. And Zebby, by the way, yeah, it was against Toronto. I always confuse like Target Field with the Cardinals stadium for whatever reason. Just in my head, like the nice sunshine. But yeah, with Zebby, it's like, well, you get the Rays and Angels still, even though that Jays one, I think that's atypical. Look, if I'm encouraged by Zebby and those, I still might go into Cleveland and Boston, just because if Zebby gets through the adversity of that start and it looks like he's cruising.
If he handles Cleveland too, then maybe you're like, all right, maybe he's just good.
Right.
Down there's also some under interesting names. Oswaldo Bido.
Bido, yeah.
Yeah. He's
such a good schedule.
He's got a really good one. Seattle, Detroit, White Sox, Cubs, and Rangers. And yeah. Then he doesn't really go have a great start in the one that he was supposed to be good at. But
yeah,
he actually, I did a query where I found guys who had both above average four seams and two seams by Stuff Plus.
Yeah.
And when I ran it, he didn't have enough innings. Again, these stupid cutoffs. and he should have been on that list. Mm. I'm really happy for him the rest of the way. Then John Gray had a great schedule and now he's on the IL.
Yeah, John. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, certain guys like Beto's been on a heater, and you know he throws hard enough that it doesn't surprise me that the Stuff Plus likes him for those. And also in that game, it was a Cal rally, two runs shot in the first inning. Otherwise, it would have been two runs in five innings, and it was fine. You know, okay, that happens. You still start him against the Tigers and White Sox, and something that I try to amplify. I mean, I didn't do a straight number ranking because I think it's impossible now. So props to you. I tried to do the impossible. Here comes Eno. But it's something that I'm at least saying to everybody. Now is so much more valuable than later. So when you have guys with bad now and good later versus good now, bad later, I will always, always, always favor the good now. Because A, we don't know what the schedule actually will be in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
B, they might be doing so well that you don't care. And C, you'll figure it out. You know, get value now, bank that.
And then
you can always find something else.
You know, Rafael Devers' shoulder's hurt, you know?
Yeah.
And Boston looks dead in the water right now. What if they're just like, you know, okay, we're shutting Devers down. Season's
right.
You know, we're not going anywhere, you know? And then all of a sudden you're like, well, you know, this offense doesn't look as scary, you know?
Exactly.
So you know, there's things like that for sure.
Man, so I
wanted to mention one more name as having a schedule that really inflated his rank, and he came up in my story today. Aaron Civale has the Giants, Cardinals, Giants, a double pack of D-backs, which is not great, but this is good now, iffy later, and the. Brewers are trying something with Civale that has been tried before. I was trying to walk a line a little bit in my story because he's obviously doing something new, but it's something that's been tried before. And why is it the Brewers are doing it better? And the reason I think it's better is because of the blobs. And so let me explain. Aaron Civale, has always been sweeper, cutter, curve. You know, those are his like primary weapons.
Yep.
Sometimes a little bit of four seam just to, you know, surprise people. And the slider has been the thing that has come and gone. More of a gyro slider that has come and gone. And my theory was, you know, oh, he can't keep it separate. And so when he went to Tampa, the Cleveland was reducing the usage of the slider. And then Tampa tried to do it. And then this year he cut it completely.
Right.
And then the Brewers are trying to bring it back. So you can't be like, well, why didn't the Guardians and Rays try this? You know, they did, but there's something a little different where if you look at the blobs for the sweeper and, the gyro slider, they are more distinct now than they've been in the past. In the past, they've just been like sort of one blob where like sweepers are more on the horizontal. And this one is there's two distinct blobs. And the way Chris Hook, their pitching coach, described it in an article on Brewer Fanatic, I think it was Jack Stern wrote it, was he's got a short, medium, long. And so he's got so many breaking balls that he has to play all the breaking balls off each other.
Oh, interesting.
And so he's got short, you know, cutter, gyro, sweeper. So he's got the short, medium, long. And if you look at the his pitch maps, the movement maps, you know, people talk about a cutter being a bridge pitch where you might have fastball and slider, and then there's a big piece of white in between. You put a cutter in there, and then the hitter doesn't can't distinguish between the fastball and slider as well because it's all becomes more of a continuum, right? The slider for Aaron Civale is his cutter because his cutter is his fastball. And so the slider is his bridge pitch.
No,
I tend to think it can work. And I have a lot of confidence in Brewer's pitching development, actually. I think it's pretty good. And so I'm thinking Aaron Civale does well for a while, and then you may want to pitch him in Arizona. Who knows?
Yeah. Civale to me, when I remember like peak Civale that we trusted, I mean, obviously him going to the Rays and having that really nice run, he had the slider working and that was cool. And then it disappeared. Fine. But I remember this being cutters and curves killing it. Mm-hmm. It would, I would always say like, I want 75% of these two in a given day, the games that he throws it absurdly amount, both of them, he's feeling them. He's killing it. Sinkers would always be like a mysterious pitch, like, please just don't hit me kind of thing. Sometimes there'd be a sweeper or a slider in there too that would mix it in, but really it's the cutter and the curve doing all the work. And I have not seen that curve look good for a bit. I mean, it's really been taking a step back, really with all the breaking balls, I would say. I've seen games with Aaron Civale where it's just like cutters and sinkers, that's it. And trying to figure it out.
I think that the, you know, I call this problem the Shane Green problem, that some people can maintain five breaking balls. You know, Max Scherzer says his in-between work is all maintaining breaking ball shapes and keeping them separate. Seth Lugo said that's a big part of what I do is because I have nine pitches, I have to make sure they're separate, you know. Civale maybe doesn't have that skill as well. And so it's, I think they kind of go in between, you know, being separate pitches and then sort of morphing together. I think, I think that's the issue, but in the short term, you know, I have hope once again.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, he did okay. Seven strikeouts yesterday, 5 innings, 300 runs. I didn't quite have the secondary stuff as I wanted. Some good curveballs in there, but not really the Civale that I'm super enthused about. I am curious about your ranking of Cutter Crawford. He's at 76. And I understand that these came out, actually, I should say 75. This came out before yesterday's game against the Mets, where he shoved for 6 innings, 8 strikeouts, etc. And now moving forward, it's Baltimore at New York, Minnesota.
That's the thing. Right. I think the hardest thing about what I put schedules in was there are some guys where you're like, yes, no, yes.
Yeah,
no,
right,
yes,
right.
No. Yep. And for Cutter Crawford, I was like,
right. So I'm kind of with you in that, like, I'm scared of those two for Cutter Crawford. At the same time, it's not like the Orioles are just always going to demolish whoever they face. it's not like the Yankees also demolished whoever. I mean, we've seen the ridiculous things with the Nationals taking them over and everything too. And hey, Patrick Corbin worked yesterday. Just saying, by the way, can't believe
it. Did you
it.
Tell people to use him?
He was a questionable start for the first time all year.
Wow.
It was against the Marlins. He was throwing a harder cutter. This is third great decent start. He's got another.
My eyebrows raised when I saw that box score for sure.
Third straight. He did well against the Yankees before it. Okay. He's throwing like two ticks harder on the cutter. And it's actually, if anyone who's been reading my daily roundups, like I could cover all 30 pitchers every day, right? I have had such a fun time writing the Patrick Corbin blurbs because it's me just shouting at him, being like, "It's nothing is working. Can you just throw cutters? They're so much better than your sinker. Just throw them." Actually, props to Corbin yesterday for throwing sinkers arm side exclusively and nailing it, and then cutters and sliders on the other side of the plate. It's like a prime Mitch Spence start from the opposite hand. You know, it was kind of cool. Nice. That's all I'm going to say. All right. That's it. That was fine. But anyway, the point of the matter.
Someone should have picked him up at the deadline.
Oh my God. Don't do this. Do not do this. So with Cutter Crawford now, I can see how this would be valuable. And I'm not necessarily saying that, like, oh no, you should have him like 30 or something like that. I feel this. Hayden Birdsong ahead.
I know. Right? I struggled with Cutter Crawford's rankings all year.
Because I was
more of a high man on him, you know, to begin the season. I think I had him in sort of the 50s or 40s.
Yeah, I did too. Right. And yeah, we're both there because of the vert and the.
It felt good. And he had a good couple of months. And then I left him in the 40s and 50s, even when he had a 2 ERA, and people were yelling at me like, ERA leader. And I'm like, but I don't think he's that good.
That's always a conversation, guys. Like, ERA leader, like, okay. Ranger Suarez and Jose Barrios was up there.
Yeah,
and
that's like, right. And what have they done since?
This doesn't matter, guys.
Yeah, so ERA is not predictive. Is I should just put that. I'm going to put that in my Twitter handle. I'm going to do that. ERA is not predictive. I'm going to put that in there. So maybe this is wrong, but our projection for him is a 4.36. He's traditionally had some real problems at home, and he's ironed out some of that, but you know, it's not just Baltimore, it's Baltimore at home. And then when you want to say, well, Minnesota is not the toughest matchup, well, that's at home. So, and then, you know, the New York one is away. So that's three straight starts. I wouldn't start him at all. Mm-hmm. So I did see versus Toronto at New York, I'd like him. And then to end the season at Toronto, but am I really going to hold him through three starts? And maybe yes, so maybe I should have had him higher, but I've struggled with his ranking all year, and maybe I dropped him at the wrong point. I did have somebody be like, oh, I'm not starting him against the Mets tonight, last night, and I didn't react in the moment, and then later I was like, oh, well, you should have. Damn, I should have told you to.
That was like tepid. I think it was at the bottom probable for me, but I understand the problem with Crawford to me, and how I've articulated it is weird. And I've never said this about, I think, any other pitcher, but I still don't feel like there's a leader pitch. Like it's really turning into his namesake, the cutter, I guess now, but especially earlier in the year, it was cutter, four seamer, sweeper really were the things. Sometimes a splitter shows up. Hey, what's up? How you doing? But really it's those three pitches, but none of them were the pitch for him. Hey, tough situation. Cool. I'm going to throw my slider, says Lugas. So I'm going to beat the four seamer, pass him. You can't touch my changeup. None of those three were like that leader for Cutter Crawford. And what we would see often would be after four or five, he would get into these jams later on. And it's like, I don't know what to throw right now because none of these are as elite as they need to be to really sustain this at this point. And to see him have success with just two yesterday is actually somewhat encouraging for me because that means maybe that cutter really is taking the form of that more defined, strong offering for him that he feels, which is like, this is my destiny.
It's gotta be a cutter. Bit of a weird mix for him given the arm slot.
Right. There are two guys I gotta talk about with you. And who are those mystery guys that are outside of Eno's top 80? We're gonna find out after this break. It isn't Nick Martinez at 83. Okay. He is the Oreo filling of the sandwich. Of Michael Wacha at 82 and Ryan Nelson at 84. And I know that you and I both of these guys, we've had conversations. One preseason, I was like, you know, I don't know, man. I think that Michael Wacha is better than Seth Lugo. And that was a fun one by me, huh? Great times. Great times.
Well, Wacha's been better than I expected, for sure.
But yeah, I mean, Seth Lugo has been better than I expected. And Wacha has his changeup back. And this is the kind of thing about Michael Wacha to me. I've always seen him as a Toby. He's a basic guy. For me, he's 3.6, 3.7 kind of ERA with a 120 whip and like a hovering 20% K rate. Especially because the changeup is still really good and he has enough other pitches to be deceptive enough so that guys can't just sit on the fastballs every time. He can just get strikes other ways and the changeup eventually will get you. And after facing Cleveland yesterday on Tuesday, obviously he did his rankings before then, but now it's Minnesota in Kansas City, then goes to Pittsburgh. He faces the Giants and the Nationals. And why do you hate Michael Wacha?
Because of his projection.
Well, yeah, but I mean, projections are stupid, you know. So why do you hate Michael Wacha? I'm just kidding.
We have a 4-5 projection on him. Wow. Using stuff plus, you know, his stuff plus is awful. His strikeout rate is awful. I mean, and then like his K minus BB is not great either. 21 minus 6 point, like 20.7 minus 6.6. That's K minus BB there. That's basically average.
Mm-hmm.
So average should be, you know, a 4+ ERA. So. It's possible that he can do soft contact because you're looking at, you know, a 3-year run with a 280-ish BABIP. But that's just a 3-year run for his career. He has a 294 BABIP. He has a regular batting average on balls in play. And, you know, even Brian Homers, he's really regular. He's really regular in every way. He doesn't get a lot of ground balls. He's getting worse ground balls than ever before. So are we betting that he's really good at soft fly balls? I don't know.
I mean, that makes sense being a change of focus guy.
I guess. Wouldn't you think those would be grounders?
No. I mean, like what we saw from like Estrada, for example, is a fly ball tendency, right? Like guys get under and lift it. They get out in front and instead of falling underneath it, they pop it up.
Yeah.
And in Kansas City, that works. I mean, to me, this is obviously the hardest thing about what, you know, my mentality of it a lot is, there are many times that you've certainly been here, but like, Nick, you're too low on Framber Valdez. And I'm like, yeah, but this guy looks lost right now. And all of a sudden then he clicks into the curveball and then bam, there he goes because of the track record.
Mm-hmm.
There are some like Michael Wacha to me. Like this is what I do with say, when Jose Quintana is on a heater with Martin Perez, with a lot of these older veterans who are more reliant on location and being kind of crafty. When they get into that feel, it sticks around for a good while. And Michael Wacha has kind of gone back and forth a bit this year, but we've seen this wake up a bit recently and with a really good schedule the rest of the way. The Royals, I know, I think they've lost 7 in a row, but it does seem like you're going to win at least one of those, if not two, of Pittsburgh, San Francisco, and the Nationals to end the year. The next one's the Twins, which I'm not that scared of, I guess. I mean, yeah, I ideally don't really want to go for that, but those
I thought I didn't want to start him for the next two. You know, Cleveland's underrated.
Oh yeah, Cleveland. I understand that you made these rankings before the Guardians.
Cleveland, one Minnesota. I didn't want to start him, but I did see that Pittsburgh, San Francisco, and Nationals one. And in fact, he is the highest ranked pitcher with a 4-5 projection.
Oh, okay. Well, there's
so, you know, like I did push him as much. And Edward Cabrera ahead of him as a 3.96 and Nick Martinez behind him as a 3.96. So like, you know, I don't like Edward Cabrera and Nick Martinez as much as their projections. And I like Wacha more than his projections. And then sometimes you get them right next to each other, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and then you also have like Nick Martinez who, I don't know what the Reds are even going to do with him.
That was the main thing, was the Reds schedule was the worst. I didn't believe any of it because it was changing as I was ranking. They called up Brett Lauder as I was doing it.
And right.
They said that they were going to do Liebrandt, like Charlie Liebrandt's kid, who's like 31 and has like one start in the major leagues. They were going to use him. Yeah. So they have no idea what they're doing right now. They've been using Nick Martinez. They used Nick Martinez in 3 days rest. Why would he? What?
Like, I don't know.
So they don't know. They're just trying to fill the innings. They without, you know, putting anybody at risk. And you know, further at risk, I guess, other than Nick Martinez. They're just like, whatever, you're old.
I feel for him because I will always beat the drum on Nick Martinez being a starter, and just some team, just let him start for a year.
He actually reminds me a little bit of Waka.
Yeah, well, his changeup is so good.
Yeah,
he doesn't throw it enough though. I'm very much of a, I think Nick Martinez believes that his changeup works because of his other pitches setting it up, and he can't throw it without it. I'm very much of like, just throw that thing. I think it's just so hard to hit and so good. And I do kind of hope that he goes to the club. I think he's a free agent at the end of this one. If not, maybe it's a 2-year deal, but I just want him to get, just send him to the White Sox. Like, let him just cook instead of Flexen or someone else there, right? Like, let him just start regularly.
Player option.
Okay.
Like 10 or 11 million. He might leave.
Mm.
Good enough.
I hope someone does pick him up and says, like, cool, we can just get filler innings.
Yeah, because it's like he won't maybe throw 180, but he also can probably throw more than 70. So it's like, you know, he's that glue guy, that sixth starter that can be on your roster.
Yeah.
And kind of start and relieve. And yeah, I mean, I think he's useful. I think he's kind of like a Jake Junis, you know, like,
oh, interesting.
You know, a guy I want. But you know, you mentioned one name on that list that I don't know what he's doing differently. Ryan Nelson.
Ryan Nelson, isn't it wild?
Why, like forever my numbers have been like, he's gonna be good. Then my numbers decide, you know what? It's been a long time. He's not gonna be good. He used to be always projected for really well because his stuff plus was good. And yeah, then, you know, our projections actually use real life results. So after a while, it becomes a little bit less important that your stuff plus is good. So Ryan Nelson for the year, 100 stuff plus projection, 4.51 ERA, 17.8% strikeout projection, really bad projections there. But recently the stuff plus is up to 107. And he's had a really good run. I mean, we're talking now,
It's a 2.88 ERA, 101 whip since, and across his last 9 games.
Yeah.
56 innings of 28% strikeout rate for Ryan Nelson. Yeah, unreal. 5% walk rate in that time.
You can go to the beginning of July and you get, 11 games started with a 2.83 ERA, 9K9. I mean, what is he doing differently though? It doesn't pop off the leaderboard for me.
He's throwing more four seamers. It's about 52% to 60%.
Bizarre. I mean, yes, that's his best pitch, but he's becoming more predictable.
Right. I want to believe that I'm looking at everything here instead of just a four seamer. Mm-hmm. But from what I've been watching of Ryan Nelson, for whatever reason, guys can hit this thing like they used to. Vert is just living better now. I mean, 17 inches last two games I've been seeing here of July and here in September. Maybe he's setting it up better with the secondaries. Maybe the slider and cutter are becoming a little bit more defined. Maybe he's just locating it better and not really making as many mistake pitches out of the zone and really just hammering inside the zone much better with it. I don't know, but what I can tell you is that four seamer at 60% usage is cooking.
Yeah.
And it is just performing really, really well. The results have followed. So I'm running with
it. I asked you at the meetup is there a chance that with everybody being so away from the fastball that somebody who's kind of crazy into the fastball people, but I don't
that
know.
That is a great question. Yeah.
Generally though, it's all like, okay, what am I going to do in Ryan Nelson? I'm going to sit fastball.
Right.
And that's like the oldest thing in the book.
Do, and it's not working.
I have to say, I don't get it. I don't really understand it.
The thing is, Ryan Nelson is Brandon Francis, Bowden Francis, but better. So when you're talking about Bowden Francis, but like, all right, well, I guess we're going to go over against Philly.
Fastball, but.
Well, to me, like, it's secondary. The splitter, I understand, came through for Francis, but honestly, game to game, it's really just four seamer working, and it's lower velocity on that four seamer, similar vert. That's like the difference I see is just, okay, fine, splitter is a little bit, but don't know, I kind of like Ryan Nelson's slider and cutter a bit. I feel like those are actually another piece of the puzzle that by 2025, I think he can figure out.
I guess here's the thing.
Yeah.
Here's a little thing. His zone percentage has gone up.
Doesn't surprise me.
And I guess that's the thing about having good fastball is that you can locate it in the zone. And so then the hitter has a choice is like, well, if I'm not going to swing at this, it's a called strike. I mean, he's in the zone. And during this stretch, he's been in the zone around 60% of the time. That's a lot. That is a lot. He should be getting destroyed for that. So
it's same zone. It's actually a slightly lower zone rate across these last nine than the previous 17 before with his four seamer.
Oh, with the four seamer.
Yeah. But maybe it's because the other pitches are doing better in the, or getting more in the zone to complement it. So it's not, they can't just spit on the others
backwards
now.
Or something.
It could be that. This is what we do, guys. Ball and play percentage on his four seamer is way down. So we're from 17% to 13%, which is a big difference. There might be part of it too. So essentially, is the swing rates down 52%, 52%? They're just not putting this thing in play.
It's so weird. I'm gonna have to kind of say I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. And at the end of the day, it's just, I don't know, but the results are working for it, and I'm here for it.
I'm looking at
Ryan Nelson,
where he throws his fastball before July 2nd. Looks like low middle low. He's not a high lock guy, even though he's got a good vert. Yeah. So it's kind of low and up and okay. So now since July 2nd.
Yeah. It's 47% high lock guys. Yeah.
And then since July 2nd, he's a little bit more high in the zone.
I don't really have that. It's pretty neutral to me. Long story short, Ryan Nelson should be believed in. He's getting the Giants. He's getting it. The Astros. Sure, the Astros game I don't really love.
The Astros is the only thing left on the schedule that I'm afraid of.
Yeah, the Brewers twice and the Giants. And he actually just took down the Giants yesterday. So he's only got four left. I'm rolling through.
So I'll take your criticism. I'll take your feedback. Nelson and Waka should be higher. They should be at least be where like Bidot is, you know, Luis Ortiz, you know, guys where I like the schedule and, and I like the player a little bit. So they should be about 10 points higher, each of them, I think.
So I got a couple more that I want to hear your take on. I mean, are you changing your tune on Taj Bradley at 30?
Yeah.
It stinks. I understand it. And also
the projection is so great. The stuff plus numbers are so great. I thought the schedule lined up all right. But it just looks to me like something that's just too much of a work in progress. Somebody I might buy, you know, into again next year. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of hard to just trust as much as 30 right now. You know, I talked to him and it was surprisingly an unraisian conversation where I was like, you know, are you trying to do this with this? Or you're throwing the cutter harder? He's like, yeah, am I? And I was like, you're getting a little more depth on the losing some depth. I forgot what it was. The depth is changing on your splitter. Like, what are you doing something different? He's like, no. And I was like, what are your cues on the splitter? He's like, just throw it. And I'm like,
okay.
All right. So what are you working on? He's like, nothing. I'm like, all right. You got it all figured out. Okay. Not exactly what I wanted to hear from a guy that like has one of the better fastballs in the league. I don't know. Like what he doesn't have that Nelson has is that kind of fastball command where you could just be like, hey, I'm just going to go heater all day, you know?
Yeah.
He can't do that. Even though the shape is great and the velo is better than Ryan Nelson, he just doesn't have that ability. And like, I still think he's going to turn out some good starts, and he's had some okay starts even in this bad stretch, but it's such a bad stretch right now. And you know, it's not obvious to me what's happening other than maybe he got a really into the fastball splitter at some point, and he's trying to bring the curve back to be, you know, at least maybe change velocity bands. Because if you think about it, his cutter and splitter are the exact same velo at 91. So he's 97 and 91.
Huh. Yeah.
So you don't have to, you're only thinking hard.
Right.
It's like hard and harder.
Right.
So if you bring in the 80 mile an hour curveball, you know, there was some research at Sabre Seminar that said that it was from the guys at Driveline, Jack Lambert and Merrick Romillo. And they talked about, you know, the Euclidean distance. So the distance that your blob makes of your pitch movements, the
Oh, I saw this. This is such a good app that Max Bay also put out there. It's amazing. Yeah.
So the distance between your pitches, it's good to have distance. But what they said was, if you have a pitch, so if you're like, this is Todd Bradley without the curve, right?
Yeah.
91, 97 with like slight differences in movement, right? If you then add the curve, who's down here, 80 with a big movement,
right?
It's good overall, but what it does is the curve does not get swings. The pitch that moves, that's the furthest from your blob, the pitch that's the furthest from your other pitch movements will not get swings. And you think about it,
it's that makes all sense.
77 mile an hour curveball from a guy who throws 95, right? The hitter's going to be like, oh, curveball. And normally they'll just be like, let it go, unless they're sitting on it. And if what you can do with those pitches is steal strikes. If Taj Bradley could steal 3 or 4 strikes a game with the curveball, I would say go ahead and do it. Throw that curveball in counts where you need to steal some strikes. Maybe he doesn't have the natural command.
I don't think to ask a guy to throw curveballs for strikes who doesn't have consistent locations.
He doesn't have a great feel for spin. That's one thing we know about him.
Mm.
And so normally you'd say, okay, have a cutter. Well, the cutter is his breaking ball. So what if he just had like a gyro slider that was his actual slider, and the cutter became the bridge pitch and became, you know, a thing that he didn't throw as often? But
I don't think we even need to do all of that.
What do you want him to do?
Kevin Gausman.
Fastball splitter.
Yeah. When he was having his success, he was 70% strikes with four seamers and splitters. You know, and what happened a lot is that they converged. That is, he was actually doing a good enough job of getting both sides of the zone up and down with four seamers and splitters. And then all of a sudden they merged into the middle too much. And he got hit because they were just looking in the same spot, essentially, in the middle. No, I think there's 100% a world that Taj Bradley just figures out how high to just
throw a ton of four seamers. Splitters, and that's it.
Just not even high, just in the zone four seamers consistently, and then splitters lower.
And splitters thrown to the same target that just drop below it.
That's it. Just do the Kevin Gausman. The thing about Kevin Gausman that I think I think we take for granted is that he is an amazing command pitcher.
He has pretty good command. Yeah, he's really good.
It's so consistent. You know, you don't see a game with Kevin Gausman where he's missing four seamers and splitters gloves.
He doesn't really do waist pitches. Yeah, Bradley.
Yeah, just always around the place he needs to be with a four seamer arm side around the zone, and then splitters generally just underneath that. And like that's just what he does all the time. Fortunately, he doesn't get as many whiffs on that splitter this year, and that's kind of why I have more volatility. But Todd probably gets those whiffs. So
interesting to have Nelson and Bradley here, where it's like good fastballs, no real feel for spin.
Yeah,
you know, but the difference is that Nelson has better command and is getting better results.
So I've got one more guy quickly to talk about with Eno, and we're gonna talk about him after this break. Eno, at 53, how are you gonna do this guy? His name is Bailey Ober. Okay, and I get it. You're terrified of Kansas City. Okay.
No, I'm terrified at the end of his schedule. Cleveland, Boston, Baltimore.
I don't care. It's Bailey Ober.
It's too far out.
Bailey Ober is so good. He is so good. Four seamers upstairs with great precision. He improved last year on his third pitch, which is kind of a merge of cutters and sliders. And then the changeup is actually one of the best right-handed changeups out there.
What happens in the bad games? It's so weird.
Yeah. I don't know. I like to think of it as
he's just like
everyone has bad games.
It's like elite. Like if you could take out you could take out four games of what he's done this year. If you could take out four games of what he's done this year, you probably have
a 2 ERA.
Like a 2 ERA, yeah.
Yeah. And this is the thing is like also I think those bad games, I think a lot of people say, oh no, when it's Bailey Ober, it's 9 earned runs instead of like 5 or 6 for someone else. And I say, no, that's unfair because that just happened to be that one small sample or two small samples.
He's done it a bunch of times this year.
Well, it's just twice. And then the other one was a 5 or 6.
5s, yeah.
Right. And like, that's just whatever. That's just weirdness. It happens. We move on. I think he's phenomenal.
To me that there might be something here that's like very deception based and that certain teams, I don't know,
they're not deceived by it.
See him well or prepare well. I mean, like the Royals, for example. Yeah, that's funny.
Nice, yeah,
that's why you mentioned it. The Royals have tattooed him for 14 runs in 6 innings so far this year. But you know, are these traject teams that are like throwing over on the traject and getting ready for that release point? Or I don't know what it is, but something makes me nervous about him. I did make jokes about him at the Sabre seminar to the Twins guys, and they weren't gonna tell me anything.
He's an extreme extension guy.
Yeah, but they also mentioned his command. They did say something about his command.
I mean, he's amazing. He's an amazing command artist too. It's really, really remarkable to me. I understand that you're scared of at Cleveland, at Boston, and Baltimore, but are you just not starting him for those? I think I'm just going to still go for it. He's performed well against great teams all year. This is why you guys got to watch the YouTube version. The face that Eno just made was the most dude, all right, come on.
I just, listen, sometimes when I have a ranking of a player, I'm just like, I have no shares. I never bought into this guy. I don't know what to do with it. I don't have that like real life, like, oh, what would you do? You know, cause I don't know. Cause I don't,
yeah,
I don't
yeah,
have
yeah,
him. I don't have this choice to make. I don't, I personally would not start him against those three. And just seeing the Kansas City thing, I would not start him for the Kansas City.
Yeah.
So I would start him. And I think the Toronto start might already be gone. So of his remaining starts, I would start him of one start. Now, I'm obviously going to be wrong, but yeah.
I mean, who cares? I'm going to be wrong a ton too here.
He is the highest ranked guy with an ERA projection over 4.2.
Sure.
So that makes sense. I do try to put some sort of common sense in my rankings and not just do the projections. And I will push guys up where I'm like, I'm not sure the projection captures everything. Like Chris Bassett is another guy with a 4.2 projection right below him that should theoretically go lower. But, you know, I do think that Chris Bassett's large arsenal has been part of, you know, Seth Lugo is the highest ranked guy with a projection his high at 44. So, you know, I see some similarities with Bassett.
And the last, and I said the last one would be the last one, but I have to say this, 88, 89, and 90, I think are guys that for a lot of people, they're just going to run with through the end. And obviously you have a different take on them. That is Andrew Heaney, who has a glorious schedule. We actually have now that Toronto start is not even that, it's just Seattle again.
But Heaney just goes in and out like nobody's business. And his recent stuff loss is 70. We found that recent stuff loss is a little bit more predictive than full year stuff loss.
Yep.
It just wasn't going in the right direction. And I was just like, I don't know what they're going to do. And at that point, I think that I thought they had a lot of people coming back. So I wasn't even sure he's going to keep his rotation spot.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's with Scherzer are probably slowing down. John Gray, obviously moving on. But this is all information since you've done it.
Yeah. So I thought Scherzer, Malley.
Malley's going to be shut down too. Yep.
Yeah. So I thought it was going to get crowded and he's be out. That's my explanation. I never liked Jordan Wicks. I still don't.
I'm not talking about Jordan Wicks. Jordan Wicks is fine. There's
Jeffrey Springs was a one that I stared at for a long time. The stuff hasn't, I don't think, come all the way back. You can just see it in the velo. He's not all the way back. He has a pretty good schedule. The results have been good. Maybe that should have been higher. This was, I think like maybe two or three starts into his return. And, you know, he is a little bit weird. When I do watch him, I'm like, I'm not sure this is good enough stuff to be a starter. That's literally how I feel when I watch him.
Oh man.
And then you look up and he's got 26% strikeout rate, 7% walk rate, and he's doing just fine as a starter.
By the way, shout out to Steve G, who just commented on the podcast talking about how angry he was at the bar people from Garage. Are you kidding me? You guys are spitting out facts, straight college course. And people are singing to Ace or IFS. I saw the sign.
I want to tread carefully because it was very nice of them to give us a space. We did not have to pay for it. And, you know, they were nice about a lot of things. And I love that place. The beers, and I want to recommend it. Beer and food is always good there. I don't know that I want to go back and do an event there because some disconnect happened. I mean, but they wouldn't let Justin Mason in. Steve, he went and had a cigarette, and they wouldn't let him back in.
Yeah, that was a little strange, but no, Steve, thanks for that. We appreciate it. Just funny. Of course, obviously, everyone, thank you so much for being there. And you guys were focused and having a great time, too. Maybe I didn't translate as much.
Thanks to Doug Thorburn and Justin Mason for coming.
Oh, absolutely. That was awesome. The last guy there was Arrighetti. It seems like you're not quite in on the massive strikeout surge that he's had.
Yeah, actually, Stuff Plus is capturing that. He is the largest Stuff Plus surger, I believe. I have that somewhere here somewhere. The Stuff Plus surgers, where are you guys?
Because it is the year of Spencer, by the way. Or Mitch Spence, Spencer Turnbull, Spencer Arrighetti, Spencer Schwellenbach, Spencer Bidens.
You're such a pitching guy. I mean, it's obviously the year of Jacksons. The largest Stuff Plus increases are Spencer Arrighetti, DL Hall, Sonny Gray. I think he's just falling in love with the sweeper again. He's throwing it.
Yeah. Well, sweeper's always going to be the
there's an art, really interesting article I recommend reading on Fangraphs about the most predictable pitchers. Sonny Gray shows up as one of the most predictable two strike pitchers. He's going sweeper. Blake Snell is up. Chris Flexen is up from 44. Stuff Plus.
What?
To 60.
Oh, congrats, buddy. Flexing at the beach. Oh, my gosh.
Joe Musgrove has a new pitch.
Oh, yeah. Wait, he does? Is it confirmed that harder slider is a real new second pitch? Because that's what I was thinking it was.
I was sitting on it for a while because I wasn't sure. It was like from a source. It was like, I was like waiting for other people to mention it so I could talk about it. But it's 87 miles an hour gyro slider.
Yeah, I love it. I remember watching that. They called it the cutter for one. I was like, this is like 86 to 91. And then watching, like, no, this looks like a different thing.
It is a different thing. And it's being captured, I think, by the cutter designation, which is inflating his Stuff Plus, which I would have more of a problem with, except that he has good Stuff Plus to begin with. And I think he's just a really good feel for spin guy. So whatever you want Aaron Civale to be, Joe Musgrove is. You know what I mean? Sure. In terms of like
100%.
I have six breaking balls and I can actually I have the feel to separate them and do what I want with them.
Awesome. All right, guys. That's it for today. I've taken too long on this one. Fantastic guest as always. Thank you all so much for watching live on YouTube for this episode. Of course, watch all of our previous episode on YouTube as well. Eno, what are you working on this week?
I don't know. I have a piece up right now. Check it out. It's about all the guys who switched teams. I talked a little bit about Aaron Civale, but Frankie Montas is doing different things on the Brewers. Kikuchi, it goes into all the changes. I forgot to do Eflin, but, sometimes guys slip between the cracks.
They always do. You know, that's just the nature of the beast. That's just
I thought what I did think was interesting that is almost every single pitcher, I think I can just say this, every single pitcher that changed hands, starting pitcher that changed hands at the deadlines made a stark change to their pitching mix with a new team.
Oh, that's interesting.
So every single player was like, you know, we want this guy and we think we can do this with him.
Oh,
in some cases, Trevor Rogers, it didn't work out.
Some cases, you say Kikuchi throwing more four seamers and sliders.
The changes they made with Eric Fetty in St. Louis, not good, I don't think.
No, probably not. I
have been throwing his 21 Stuff Plus four seam more often.
Wow. That's a number that I didn't expect you to say or hear today.
It's a Flexinesque number.
So that's minus 79%.
Yes. It has 800 slugging.
Yeah, can we just do that like a minus instead of a like a I don't know. Oh gosh. But anyway, guys, thank you all so much for listening today. Of course, I'm your host, Nick Pollock, on behalf of Enosaurus. I enjoy the craft of pitching again live on YouTube next week.